This week on Your Western Context, Irving is hiring foreign workers to build warships. Alberta media tries to change the topic from energy to climate change. And the BC repeat offender expert panel advocates for stronger mental health support. Also, Arrive Can is no more. This is Western Context, episode 287, recorded Saturday, September 24th, 2022. Precarious problems. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back this week, as we have been since 2017, and we have this week again a full slate of news to discuss, including some news that, as per how it goes here on Western Context, news that you likely have not heard about yet.
Yes, that's for sure. And as summer turns into fall, we hope that people are still experiencing good weather across the country, despite the tropical storm Fiona currently wreaking havoc in eastern Canada as we record. So we hope any of our listeners that are based in that part of the country are staying safe, and hopefully this will pass soon, and hopefully everybody will be able to rebuild properly after it is over. But in the meantime, we have lots of news to talk about this week, some that hasn't really been covered that much, some that we've gone over before, and we've got updates for you, and certainly a lot that has not been really covered by the mainstream media properly. Despite there being a subsidized media industry in Canada, there is a lot that falls through the cracks, and definitely a lot for us to talk about this week.
That's right, and if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is the podcast that aims to cut through all that media bias and sensationalism that you find wherever you get your news, whether it's from the TV news, the newspaper news, online news, which it's very prevalent online, or social media, anywhere you get your news, actually. Our whole goal is to provide that extra little bit of information and context to allow you to cut through all that media bias and sensationalism. And hopefully, when we do that, all the information and context we provide to you will put you on the right side of the news. And with that, we're going to begin with a story talking about the Irving shipyards out east. But if you want to follow along with us, you can find full show notes available at westerncontext.ca.
Yes, and the domestic warship building program that the federal government has been lauding for quite some time now as being able to provide Canadians with well-paying jobs for Canadians is now actually under fire for outsourcing its jobs to foreign workers. Now, Irving Shipbuilding, of course, anybody who lives in the East will know about Irving. Well, they want to bring in more foreign workers to help construct the Canadian Navy's new fleet of warships. Now, Irving is involved in a recruiting campaign to bring in workers from the Philippines as it gets ready to construct the first of 15 Canadian surface combatants. Now, the Embassy of the Philippines in Ottawa is actually helping with Irving recruiting campaign. On September 20th, under the banner of, quote, Filipinos invited to build Canadians' naval fleet, it noted that a delegation from the embassy and the Philippine Overseas Labor Office actually visited Irving Shipbuilding on September 19th, where they were received by the firm's Human Resources Vice President, Jim Rennie. Now, the embassy, the Filipino embassy in Ottawa, said in a statement, quote, with Irving Shipbuilding contracted to build the CAF's next-generation Canadian Surface Combatants fleet, the company is currently recruiting Filipino shipbuilding employees to meet its manpower requirement for this critical contract. During the meeting, which followed the worksite visit, Rennie provided an overview of the support services they have in place to ensure the successful integration of their prospective Filipino employees to the company and the Halifax community. Now, Mary Keith, who is the Irving Vice President of Communication, said that 98% of the company's workforce is Canadian and that the firm's priority is to hire Canadians with experience. She stated that foreign workers are being brought in by the firm, quote, are achieving permanent residency and citizenship, contributing to Canada's economy. Now, she noted that the shipyard union, Unifor Local 1, is aware that the firm is seeking skilled trades workers inside and outside of Canada, and that those individuals would be union members. She said, quote, "We currently have approximately 250 open positions for staff, leadership, and skilled trades." Now, in a May 2020 appearance before a Commons committee, the Innovation, Science, and Economic Development Deputy Minister, Simon Kennedy, claimed that the federal government's shipbuilding strategy had created or maintained almost 17,000 Canadian jobs. Kennedy also claimed that ISED officials were regularly working on the surface combatant project with Irving and others to ensure that the economic benefits promised to Canada were implemented. But when asked for comment on Irving's recruitment campaign, ISED said that they could not respond because the issue does not, quote, fall under the department's purview. Now, Irving employees have said that the firm is losing skilled Canadian shipbuilders because the firm is not paying enough and benefits are lacking. Not only that, but the budget for the project has ballooned from about $26 billion to almost $60 billion, so just over double. Now, critics of the shipbuilding program point out that the surface combatant project has spun out of control, with some parliamentarians now suggesting that the price tag has climbed to $100 billion. Conservative MP Kelly McCauley, who is on the Commons Government Operations Committee, said that the push to hire foreign workers for the new warship program is disappointing. McCauley said that there should be also an emphasis on recruiting Indigenous people for such jobs and questioned the lack of training for shipbuilding trades for Canadians. McCauley said, quote, "We have had government and industry officials repeatedly telling our committee about all the great jobs this program will create for Canadians. I find it very disappointing that after the tens of billions of dollars thrown to Irving for shipbuilding, that they are not reaching across our country to recruit workers." Now, Irving has previously brought in foreign workers. In 2017, the Chronicle Herald newspaper in Halifax had reported about Irving hiring workers from Poland to work on the Royal Canadian Navy's ships. Irving also had a deal with the Spanish firm Gabadi LC that involved Spanish carpenters being brought to Halifax to work on the Navy's Arctic and offshore patrol boats. Now, at the time, Irving claimed that the newspaper reports were false, but it then released a statement confirming that the foreign workers were being recruited. Irving noted in the statement at the time, quote, "Because Canada has not had a naval new build program in place for almost 25 years, some specific shipbuilding expertise does not exist in Canada, or we have exhausted efforts to recruit Canadians for certain positions. Under these exceptional circumstances, skilled workers need to be sought internationally." Now, in June of 2018, David Baker Mosher, who is the president of Unifor Local MWF1, said that the union workers at Irving objected to temporary foreign workers in the yard, saying that the issue has, quote, "created huge animosity." Baker Mosher told reporters that while Irving was hiring foreign employees, he knew of skilled workers who had to leave Nova Scotia to take jobs in Western Canada, in particular Alberta. Now, earlier this year, it was revealed that Procurement Canada was actually quietly seeking what it called influencers to push out social media messages that the government's shipbuilding program was a success. And this is where the story gets weird, because the influencer recruitment program was aimed at officials in various companies and defense analysts and academics who are deemed supportive of the national shipbuilding strategy. They were to be provided with positive messages and data by Procurement Canada about federal shipbuilding, with an emphasis on jobs being created. Now, the potential influencers were told by Procurement Canada that, quote, "The NSS has resulted in many social and economic benefits, from creating and sustaining more than 16,000 jobs annually to showcasing the innovations applied to shipbuilding, and we know we have content that would be of interest to your followers and networks." So as we can see, the federal government has been keen to see positive news about the story, but as we can see, Irving has not changed with the times. Now, good companies have responded to 2022's worker shortage by raising pay, benefits, and other worker-friendly actions in order to attract and, most importantly, retain good employees. And if a company does not do this, then there is little incentive for workers to stay when they could get different work elsewhere that pays better. Now, most companies in Canada need to realize that they cannot just outsource everything and remain on good terms with Canadians. Now, as for the government, it's clear that these huge contracts that balloon in cost need oversight on how the funding is actually spent and how the companies involved have supported Canadians in the past. And as for the social media influencer campaign to try and get messaging on side with this, it's clear that that's not working very well either, because Irving is not doing them any favors by recruiting foreign workers right after the huge push for domestic workers. So it's clear that the government needs to do more on this issue, and, well, it's clear that Irving isn't doing the right thing in this case as well.
This is a bizarre story, because when you start peeling back the layers of this, it looks like it's just a case that the ship company in general, Irving, is not hiring Canadian workers. That's what it looks like. But as what we can see here, there's been huge amounts of money that have gone to the company by way of the government, and as you mentioned in the story, Irving is not following what most good companies are doing this year in terms of increasing pay and benefits and the like. And with that, you have to wonder just what the company is planning on doing, whether they're planning on getting more government money and hiring workers who are going to work for less, when in reality they should be hiring Canadian to build these big, huge Canadian boats that are going to be flying the Canadian flag. It would make sense that that's what would happen on this. But once again, this has been the story in the past of government contracts that go out to, in this case, defense manufacturers that just go up and up in cost, and in reality, in the end, don't give the benefit that people expect from them. And this is something that is horribly undercovered in the media, and that's probably because it's from a defense angle. Not too many bureaus out there have somebody who is able to dive into the weeds onto this and do all the research and have the contacts in the defense industry and the like to report on this, but the angle that we're presenting here on Western Context is something that you won't see in the media, and we're just in effect connecting the dots between all of the different stories that have been published on this, and once again, it really raises the question of why this isn't done in the media in day-to-day life, and that's why we do here what we do at Western Context.
Yes, when you search Irving in the news, you don't actually see very much on this story, because there's really very few outlets that have actually reported on this. And it's interesting because of all of the press releases that Irving put out and all of the different government departments that are involved in this, Innovation, Science, and Economic Development, as well as Procurement Canada, you know, that you'd think that there'd be a paper trail for this story, but there's definitely nothing out there, at least nothing that we could see. And that means that there's a lot of people that are wanting to see this being covered up. And as you could see with this social media campaign that they're trying to put out, they're trying to put out good news and cover up the bad. And what this means is that people aren't getting what the actual story is. And it's very difficult to find out what the real solution is and what's actually going on. And I think that within this particular case with Irving, it's clear that they're having trouble attracting and keeping workers, especially those that have the expertise of shipbuilding experience that is required, because after all, it is a very skilled trade and you have to have particular knowledge. So maybe there's something there with some of that $60 billion. Maybe should be going towards trade schools to actually train people and train Canadians in Canada so that they actually have this expertise. And maybe if the benefits and pay were there, a lot of people would be wanting to go into this sort of work. But if they're not there, then why would they bother? So at this point, we need to see that Irving is not really doing what it should to keep and hold their Canadian workers. And instead, they're trying to go outside of Canada. Well, this is something that many companies have done in the past. of course, with the temporary foreign worker policy that was under fire quite a bit about a decade ago. And, you know, this is something that needs to be covered more because it's not Irving isn't the only company that's doing this, but they're certainly one of the bigger ones in Canada.
That's right. And of course, at the end of the day, there's government subsidies involved, and that means taxpayers' money. Anybody who's listening to this does have some portion of their money going towards this. So it's definitely something that should be raising the eyebrow of all Canadians, and that's why we talk about this and other stories like this here at Western Context. And if you want to help us do that, if you want to help us with the podcast each and every week, you can check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/Western Context. And there we offer three tiers of support where you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to, starting for as little as $2 a month. You'll be helping us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain, of course, pre-release access to our production throughout the entire week. Now, of course, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article, like a newsletter, expanding on topical stories of the month. And this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. And with that, we move to Alberta. And of course, the sole obsession of the UCP government as elected in 2019, as they said, was jobs, the economy, and pipelines. And keep in mind, this government was elected with more than 50% of the popular vote in 2019, representing more than 1 million people. And as far as majority mandates go, that's a pretty strong mandate. Now, the reason we're talking about this is the ongoing UCP leadership race that has drawn focus week after week for controversy behind the race and not the actual policy most of the time. And when the policy does come up, it's focused on around one or two policy planks and not much else gets talked about. And because of that, there's still, of course, the question of the fact that something's not being talked about. What that means, basically, is that a lack in policy in certain areas is still policy around it. And that's what many people who are members of the UCP, members of the small C conservative contingent, who are members of that party, see as a feature, not a bug, pushing forward the ideals of small government. And there have been questions about where the candidates stand on the environment and climate, specifically with regards to the oil industry. And the reason we're talking about this is that question got asked this week by CBC, and the CBC is particularly asking, well, why isn't this being talked about? Why isn't this being asked to the leadership candidates? And this is an answer that most people will hopefully know, but the answer is simple. The investment climate that was perpetuated by the Notley NDP and the Trudeau Liberals federally is not healthy for the province, and that goes completely counter to what the UCP was elected to do in 2019. It's as simple as that. As a listener of this podcast or as a UCP member, you can agree or disagree with that, but that's precisely why the candidates are not talking about it. It has also forced the North American-based oil producers to pledge to achieve net zero emissions by 2050, both what we saw under the NDP here in Alberta and what the federal government under Justin Trudeau is pushing for, has forced many of those North American-based producers to say that they will push for net zero by 2050. Now, we of course need to say that the environment and climate is important and that ensuring global emissions do come down over time is important, but the economy of jurisdictions that produce energy cannot be kneecapped in a goal to reach net zero faster. Now, of course, we have to then talk about what's actually happening when it comes to global emissions. Now, global emissions are still rising and haven't peaked. Current targets will reduce emissions, but they won't reach the international targets that were set out by the famous 2015 Paris Treaty or the Kyoto Treaty of the early 2000s. Those targets will not be met with what's going on presently. As of 2019, and we're gonna kind of break apart where all these emissions are coming from and why talking about it here in Canada is interesting. So as of 2019, China accounted for about 24% of global greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. was 11.5%, India was 6.7%, and Canada represented 1.4% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And you can, of course, look to the emissions when it comes to the energy industry as well, and you can see that Canada sits at a similar relation, and it's mostly due to the energy industry that we're at that 1.4%, but we're still at 1.4% out of 100 when you have countries like China that are almost a quarter of all global greenhouse gas emissions. Now, with these numbers on hand that were provided by the wonderful website called Our World in Data, which we highly recommend you go have a look at. They got lots of interesting articles on there about the environment, about oil and what oil is used for and all of its various applications and such. COVID data, too. If this sounds interesting to you, just go check that out. You can find a link in the supplementals at westerncontext.ca. And following from all this data, oil companies had to pledge that net zero because that's the only way for them to operate under the Trudeau administration or Notley's NDP in Alberta when they were in power. There's also, of course, the realization that needs to be made that Canadian oil is more cleanly produced than oil found everywhere else, like in Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. Then you factor in the human rights factor, and there's a story that nobody really talks about, but we have, of course, time and time again here at Western Context. Now, from this purely analytical and non-ideological perspective based on numbers and facts, we can see why the UCP leadership candidates haven't touched the issue. And at the end of the day, numbers and facts on their own are rather innocuous and haven't hurt anybody. And as a result of that, it's most of the interpretation that comes from that and the spin that's put on that that causes people to feel one way or another about that. Now, the CBC article goes through each candidate and asks why they haven't mentioned net zero and then goes on to seem surprised when the candidates ultimately push for more pipelines. Now, the best analogy for what's happening in this article and what an NDP government would do is the idea of is an idea similar to of what vultures do when they start circling their prey. The case is made that the energy industry has had a year of record profits, which is indeed true, and therefore it should allow the companies to invest more in green energy and other initiatives to lower emissions. But we need to remember that with everything related to energy, it all comes back to the economy. And the economy is a psychological engine that requires positive signals for it to work at high efficiency. The solutions to the climate crisis need to come from private industry and need to be economically feasible. Whether that option is greening the existing industry here in Alberta or moving to hydrogen or nuclear, only the most economical solutions going forward will provide the answer. By making every economically feasible effort to green the energy industry, Alberta and Canada, by extension, can then buy the right to tell other energy producers globally that they need to clean up their energy production and manage the human rights concerns that pop up in some of the energy-producing nations. And for those who can read between the lines or read the economic data coming out of the energy industry, combine that with our record, this means that Canada should go green in the energy industry, not only to lower our own tiny amount of emissions globally, but also to encourage other energy-producing countries to do the same, but of course we know they won't. This is in all likelihood the policy stance that the UCP leadership candidates and eventual premier will take, but we need to keep in mind that the current state of the race requires the candidates to appeal to the core policy concerns of the UCP members who are presently sending in their mail-in votes. And those policy concerns in general are not carbon taxes, lowering emissions, or net zero, as economically viable as they might or might not be. They still come back to the jobs, the economy, and the continued growth of pipelines as the UCP was elected with back in 2019.
This highlights the very importance of what market share does. So for companies that have a high amount of market share in a particular product or a particular sector, this means that if they have a higher market share, they have higher control over what that market does. And this means that for companies like, say, McDonald's in the fast food industry, they can set very high standards or as low standards as they want for how their food is produced, made, shipped, and even packaged or presented as the final product. This means that every other fast food company out there has to look at what they're doing and either try to make it better, either by making their product tastier, or they have to make it not as expensive, or they have to find ways to compete. And this means that if you have a higher market share in a particular area, the others will look to you for direction, whether they realize it or not. So this means that if Canada wants to have higher clout on the world stage, as Trudeau very famously said back in 2015 when he was elected, and he said Canada was back, the previous 7 years has shown that Canada really isn't back on the world stage, because no one really pays that much attention to Canada, because Canada doesn't really have much of a market share when it comes to foreign policy. So what does this have to do with greenhouse gas emissions within Canada? Well, this shows that, you know, not many countries out there are going to look to Canada for their for policies on how they run their oil industries, because Canada can't even figure out how to run its own oil industry. And with all these stifling regulations, bureaucracy, and a lot of the red tape that has cropped up, it means that Canada's market share in global energy has dropped by what it could be. And that means that people aren't going to be, politicians, leaders outside of Canada, they're not really going to be looking to Canada for answers. So all of the strict regulations that we have and the greenest energy that we have outside of the other nations in Europe, you know, we're not really seeing many other places that have as high human rights standards, as well as cleaner energy producing nations out there. So, you know, there's not many other countries out there, say OPEC, they're not really going to be looking to Canada for solutions because Canada can't really figure it out itself. And a lot of this comes down to what the federal government's policies have been for the past 7 years. And, you know, this is something that's not really going to change. So, at least until the federal government changes. So when it comes down to the UCP in Alberta, there's not really much they can really do at this point, because a lot of it has to do with the federal government and not the provincial one. But when it comes down to it, Canada has a route that they can take, but currently they're not taking it right now. And that's something that really just doesn't get talked about enough in the media, because they're not really connecting those dots.
Yeah, and that's a perfect analogy, that Canada needs to become the McDonald's of the energy industry in terms of setting the high standards, both environmentally and on the side of human rights. And to do that, we do need to grow the industry and grow it in a green, sustainable way. And that's something that a lot of people who advocate for climate action do not get, is that all of these things are intertwined together. You really can't have one without having the other, and the only real substantive option, instead of going the approach of becoming the energy superpower and doing it in a green, sustainable way, the only other option is to, in effect, ramp down the industry, which is what we saw under the Notley NDP, and we continue to try and see efforts of that under the Trudeau administration as well, and everything the UCP stands for goes counter to both of those, and that's precisely why the UCP leadership candidates are not talking about that, despite the question popping up in CBC Calgary articles asking, well, shouldn't this be a topic of the leadership race? No, it shouldn't, because that's not what the UCP members stand for, and that's not what they want to talk about right now. It's as simple as that. But with that, we're going to move on to another healthcare theme story in British Columbia.
Yes, indeed. And earlier this spring, we discussed on Western Context 264, the problem of increased crime in BC, especially in smaller communities. Now, the problem back then was seen by local business owners and city councillors across the province as not being an issue of policing, but with the court's revolving door justice system, which allowed repeat offenders, or prolific offenders, as it was called back then, back onto the streets after they commit crimes. Now, just over a month later on Western Context 269, we went over the province's response to this, which was to set up an expert panel with former Deputy Vancouver Police Chief Doug Lepard and health researcher and criminologist Amanda Butler, who studied the issue of repeat offenders and how to solve the problem. Now, this week, their report was submitted back to the province, and they provided 28 recommendations to the province. Now, the bulk of the guidance released is centered on mental health treatments and mental health supports, rather than overhauling the criminal justice system. Now, the 14-page report made a series of recommendations, the bulk of which revolve around addressing what the report calls, quote, critical gaps in the continuum of care for people with mental health and substance use needs who are involved with the criminal justice system. Now, the report says, quote, currently mental health-related crisis response in BC is primarily left to police and hospital emergency departments, both of which have been shown to contribute to adverse outcomes for people in crisis. We need a broader and more creative set of solutions. Now, Public Safety Minister Mike Farnworth said, quote, this report confirms the complexity of the challenge. The recommendations show how much more work we have to do, which is government speak for saying we have done none of this so far, and it's going to take a long time for us to fix this. Now, Lepard and Butler, who were asked to study the issue of repeat offenders back in May, are also recommending additional resources to support those who were released from custody. Now, the report says, quote, unfortunately, there is a shortage of resources available to meet the needs of people who have been incarcerated when they are released. This is a crisis that must be ameliorated. Now, many people return to precarious housing, shelters, or homelessness, and back to communities where they are at high risk of returning to crime because their needs remain unmet by the systems that should be supporting them. Now, earlier this year, the BC Urban Mayors Caucus sent an open letter to the province calling for stronger bail conditions, stricter consequences for breaching those conditions, and stronger consideration for maintaining public confidence in the administration of justice in bail and charge assessment policies. Now, earlier this month, Peter Juck, who is the Assistant Deputy Attorney General and head of the BC Prosecution Service, issued a lengthy statement saying that the criminal justice system, acting alone, lacks the capacity, tools, and legal authority to remedy underlying social problems and to fill the gaps left by other sectors of society. Juck said, quote, the public deserves to receive the real facts about the criminal justice process and the strict legal requirements imposed by the Parliament and the Supreme Court of Canada, and about the real limits on what Crown Counsel and the criminal justice system can and cannot do to address broader social issues like mental health and the addiction crisis. Now, the amount of time that the province takes to review files that it receives from police has shot up 118% since 2017, while the rate at which the BC Prosecution Service chooses to not charge suspects based on police evidence has risen by 75%. Now, Farnworth has committed to acting on three of the recommendations immediately. The BC government will now explore the creation of a provincial committee focused on coordinating communication and service integration between health, criminal justice, and social service organizations. And the province is also committed to revisit the prolific offender management model that formed the basis of the pilot projects from 2008 to 2012. Now, the management model will create a cohort of people who are involved in repeat crime using a selection prioritization tool and identify the unique needs of each person in the cohort. Now, the report also noted that due to decreased crime reporting, official reported crime statistics may not provide an accurate picture of crime trends in BC. For example, the Vancouver Police Department reported that in the first 3 months of 2022, 40.5% of calls to the non-emergency line managed by ECOM went unanswered due to lack of capacity. Now, along with an executive summary and the list of recommendations, the province also issued the BC First Nations Justice Council's submission to the panel, which expresses, quote, reservations about the panel's ability to build relationships, rebuild trust, reduce harm, and break the cycles of structural inequalities that perpetuate harm. The report itself acknowledges that concern that, quote, there are many voices that are missing from our consultations, namely the voices of Indigenous communities. And Surrey Board of Trade President Anita Huberman said that the report was in line with the recommendations previously made by her organization, but that she accused the panel of ignoring the voices of business owners in their consultations as well. So while there may be reservations with how the expert panel did its work, the conclusions that it reached seem fairly obvious to many, that the systems set up by the province have failed those and have led to a huge problem with crime that proper mental health and systemic supports could solve. Now, the major issue is with that is that our healthcare system is already in crisis and much needs to be done, and it's not just something that throwing money at will fix. If the BC NDP government is serious about solving this issue, then there is a lot to do.
And I'd like to highlight for the listeners that we're not talking about something that started in March of 2020 and continued to get worse through 2022. We're talking about things that have been getting worse since 2017. And of course, the events of the last 2 years have compounded everything and made everything worse in that regard. But the very fact things have been getting worse since 2017 also highlights that there are systemic problems when it comes to these issues that need to be dealt with. And these are the kind of issues that seemingly, again, don't get reported in the media, or the government bureaucracy is aware of them, but it's taking too long for it to find a solution and implement that solution. Or they're trying to find a solution, but it's not making it to the front line, and people are still being impacted by this day by day. And, you know, once again, I think this is showing a story of how ineffective the opposition in BC has been over the past couple of years, because this should be front page news and this should be something that the NDP government is being hammered on. But the opposition is nowhere to be seen on this in terms of setting the agenda and the media cycle with this. We're lucky we found a few sources on this. But a lot of the discussion on this really doesn't come back to the opposition as well. It comes back to the government and the solutions that they're trying to present that so far are not working. And we're just going to have to wait and see if anything comes from this, or if anybody takes up this issue and pushes it a little bit harder.
Yes, I think that a lot of people that are opponents of the BC NDP government were looking to new BC Liberal leader Kevin Falcon and hoping that he would be able to find a voice and actually, provide a stable opposition to what the government is doing. But so far, they have been absent in action yet again on this issue, and there has not really been much of a discussion going on about what's going on in BC with the problems with crime. A couple days ago, we saw a news report out of Victoria that saw a attacker on a bus who attacked a bus driver and was later found by police to have been on. He was wanted in Ontario on warrants for a previous murder, and he was actually stopped by police who had found out about this warrant, and yet he was still walking free. And the police in Victoria couldn't actually say why he was still on the streets and why he wasn't locked up and found out because of this warrant that happened in Ontario. So there was a lot of answers that weren't really given on that particular story, but it's just one particular case of certain things that are going across the province where criminal activity is usually perpetuated by people who have already created crimes in the past. And it seems like the amount of crime that has happened in the province is is committed by a very small group of people that have been creating a lot of the crime, or at least a very large percentage of it. So, of course, while the province and this panel will talk about an increase in mental health supports, an increase of different solutions that the province hasn't tried yet, that's all well and good, because definitely there does need to be more mental supports, but it doesn't need to just be aimed at criminals and certainly repeat criminals. And systemic supports shouldn't just be for the criminal justice system. This needs to be available for everyone who needs it. And I think that when it comes down to it, mental health supports in this province have been sorely lacking for quite some time now. And, this crisis that we've had with healthcare over the past couple of years has just made it worse. And certainly, there's a lot that governments have been very slow to fix, and the BCNDP have been, no different in that regard. And it's something that Canada-wide, the provincial government needs to work with the federal government on this issue. And it's something that the Trudeau Liberals could be doing a little bit more on as well, because this is something that comes down from the Supreme Court of Canada and from direction given by Parliament. So there is definitely lots of federal laws on the books that have not helped with this. It's been mentioned that there's definitely laws that could be adopted from other countries that have helped with sentencing people based on mental health problems, such as Britain, who has lots of laws on the books regarding this, but Canada doesn't really have those. So there's definitely lots of solutions to this problem that can be discussed and definitely can be tried, but it's clear that the status quo isn't working, and right now there has been little response in the media, and certainly no response from the official opposition on this matter, and there's definitely not much out there when it comes to this story. So I think that, there's definitely lots to talk about, but nobody's talking about it, and I think that's the main issue with this.
That's right, and that's why it's so important to have a media that's actually focused on the core matters of the story and not the fluff around the edges. But we're going to move on into our firing line right now, and the firing line is typically the story where we talk about something that hasn't been talked about that much, or it's been covered in completely the wrong way. This has been talked about many different times, but what we're talking about this time with this one is a slightly different angle that has not been covered yet. And what we're talking about is the impending disappearance of the ArriveCan app at our borders and the federal vaccine mandates for those wanting to come into the country. And there hasn't been an announcement made yet on this. We're expecting the announcement to come in the final week of September, with the potential droppage of ArriveCan and the vaccine mandates on September 30th. But nonetheless, this is something that should be talked about, because if sources are to be believed, the government has already made the decision. They just haven't actually put the information out there yet. And this is a big story because Canada is one of the last countries in the world to require proof of vaccination for entry, and the use of the ArriveCan app has at times over the past summer and time it has existed proved to be very glitchy, causing lots of problems and delays for people wanting to come into the country. Now, the news has been almost all but confirmed in certainty by government sources at the bureaucratic level. As I said, as we open the story, all we're waiting for is the official press conference on this. And the reason everybody wants to see these restrictions lifted is that both the vaccine mandate and ArriveCan have contributed to delays at the airports. That's what they've done physically. But they've also been great sources of disruption and division within the country. The nagging issue of vaccine mandates and delays has been one of the easiest to visualize for new conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, and he built the early days of his campaign about getting rid of all the mandates. Now, with that, the airport chaos can be visualized at any of the major airports, but most certainly it was the biggest problem at Toronto Pearson this summer, with lines stretching seemingly forever. But moving now on ArriveCan and mandates, if the Trudeau Liberals do decide to do that, They are going to be removing one of the planks that has been an effective battering ram for the new conservative leader against the Trudeau Liberals and the establishment as it is in the country. Now, the reason that both the ArriveCan app and the mandates have been proven to become a big issue is that, as highlighted in a CTV piece by Don Martin, airport arrivals would test positive at or below the same rate as the general public for people who would be coming into the country with COVID. So it makes sense that dropping the random testing and dropping the vaccine requirement really isn't going to be doing that much when you have a higher rate of COVID in schools, in workplaces, in various cities across the country. And as we long knew about the variants on hand, airport surveillance wasn't that good for finding these compared to something like looking at wastewater that has been treated. And this is something that many big cities started to do last year, is that they would look at their wastewater data to see when COVID would be on the rise, and that would give them a lead time of about 2 or 3 weeks before the cases would start appearing in the hospitals and doctors' offices. And with that, that's also a good way to scout for new variants as well. Thankfully, no new variants have emerged recently, and no new variants have emerged or rather originated in Canada. There's also some unsubstantiated claims put forward in the CTV article that definitely do bear looking into, in that folks in Mexico could buy negative COVID test results that they could use to get into Canada. And there's a documented case of pharmacies in states like Texas selling fake proof of vaccine documents that Americans could use to get into Canada and that were accepted at our ports of entry. What this means is that it's entirely possible that people were admitted into Canada with illegal documents. Well, law-abiding Canadians who were using the ArriveCan app or might have been behind on one of their vaccines were stuck to quarantine in a hotel, and were, as we talked about when the hotel quarantine program started, were effectively fed slop in those hotels. Now, with this, assuming that the government does act and drops the ArriveCan app and the vaccine mandates, this will mark the end of one of the most divisive periods in Canadian history. And your hosts here at Western Context will know that the vaccine mandate and entry app did not need to be divisive, but the government and media in this country, both on the left and the right, sought to use the issue to wedge Canadians against one another. And we saw that in display in full earnest in last year's federal election. What this led to is strained relationships amongst families and friends, and at worst, broken friendships and sometimes families, but also a general degradation of the civility of Canadian politics that were enjoyed for so long before. It's been long said in this country that once upon a time, a progressive conservative and liberal wanted the same things for the country, they just had a different path of how to get there. That's, of course, changed over the last 20 years, but that gap has widened so much over the last 2 years, largely due to the pursuit of wedge politics and the polarized media landscape that we have in our country. The big questions going forward are what are going to be the next big wedge that are employed by the Trudeau government and followed up on by the media, and whether or not the division from the last 2 years will be able to be repaired. It will require a leader who's able to communicate, to cut through the media fog and set the media cycle to allow the next wedge to not take root, as has been the case over the last 7 years when the wedges were employed by Justin Trudeau. So as with all things here at Western Context, this is a story we've been following for about the last 2.5 years or so at this point when it comes to what kind of restrictions are in place and were in place for this country. We'll, of course, be watching to see what the actual announcement says and what sort of language is used behind that and whether or not there's any media reaction, good or bad, left or right, that needs to be talked about when that announcement is made. And if there is, we'll, of course, bring that back to the podcast. But it is our hope that at this point we'll be able to leave the divisiveness of the past 2 years behind us and focus on, of course, what has and hasn't been talked about in the media, as is the core mission of this podcast.
Yes, indeed. And I think when you look at this story, this is something that has been going on for quite some time and was definitely perpetuated by the Trudeau government for much longer than I think anyone reasonably expected it to, much because of what happened earlier in the winter and spring this year with the convoy protests in Ottawa. A lot of that was used by the government to actually extend or even strengthen its mandates and use it as an excuse to strengthen their regulations and to double down on what they had decided. And of course, back then, when most countries around the world were lifting their mandates, Canada did not, mainly because many people believe that Trudeau didn't want to do it because he didn't want to be seen as ceding control of the situation to the protesters, which he very, you know, firmly had a deep dislike of, as was referenced in many times when he was asked about it. So this is something that probably went on in Canada much longer than it needed to because of the government stubbornness. Now, it's very interesting timing how we just have a new conservative leader get elected who was, you know, very much elected on a promise to end these mandates and to campaign against them. And not 2 weeks later after being elected, you know, these mandates have now gone away. I don't think that's a coincidence, and definitely not many people in the media have actually talked about that link, but it's something that is definitely worth mentioning. And, you know, if Pierre Poilievre is to be believed, then he is the large reason as to why the government decided to do this. And, you know, if Trudeau government press releases are to be believed, then they are, you know, they are just following the science and deciding to end the mandates based on that. So I think that, you know, there's a lot out there that is not really getting talked about. And there's a lot of truth that is to be discovered. But you have to go searching quite far into the grass to actually find that truth, because so much of it has been covered up in wedge politics and polarized media reports over the last couple of years that, you know, it's hard to see what the actual issue really was.
Yeah, and when we start pulling back the layers of all this, it's very clear that throughout the last 6 months or so, last 7 months, when the leadership race was happening, the continued discussion about this and what the prime minister was doing was ammunition for Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives. And it's very clear now at this point that they want to take that ammunition away from the Conservatives on that front to ensure that they're not going to be able to have that battering ram. And if they don't, there's of course going to be something else that they will find, unless the prime minister somehow manages to become the great unifier and is able to unite East and West, English-speaking Canadians, French-speaking Canadians, people who are conservative, people who are liberal. If the prime minister were to be able to unite those, then you would start to see that maybe there might be some sort of different discussion happening. But as we know, and as we have seen since 2015, the way this government works is that it wedges one group of people, one person against another person, cabinet ministers against other cabinet ministers, various companies against other companies, various regions against different regions. It just goes on. And it's a pattern of behavior that's unlikely to change. So we'll be keeping an eye out of what happens next and whether or not the situation in the country is going to improve. And with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is precarious, which is defined as not being securely held or in position and dangerously likely to fall or collapse. Now, precarious has definitely been a word that has been described, that has been used to describe our healthcare system and definitely our criminal justice system in the past. But, you know, it could be used to describe many other things, such as the precarious hold that the government has over the media and how they can sometimes go off track from what they actually want the messaging to be about. And definitely, you know, this is something that we've seen in many stories over the past month or so. And precarious describes many different things in Canada right now, and we only hope that as we get into the fall and towards the last quarter of the year that things will improve for Canadians going forward.
There's so many precarious distractions and diversions in this country that are capitalized on by the media, capitalized on by the Prime Minister. And that's why this discussion that we have this week and we have each and every week at Western Context here is so important. And that's why we make sure that we document everything. We document our full show notes. We document the supplementals. You can find all those and more at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, Spotify, and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where we post the shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media is talking about and a lot that they aren't talking about, and discovering what the real news is in Canada and why exactly they matter to Canadians. Now, whether they're on radio, TV, print, or online, we will find them and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. With that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.